Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Scientists across the country will take to the streets on Saturday to draw more connections between our everyday lives and the work that they do. Some in the scientific community are reluctant to march because politics and science usually don't mix. We're going to talk today about what has triggered this uncharacteristic activism among scientists and what's happening downtown on Saturday. Joining us is Ohio State University graduate student and one of the organizers of the Columbus March for Science, Christian Butna. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Also, freelance science writer and organizer for the Columbus March for Science, Laura Sammons. Welcome.
Thank you.
There's the National March for Science in Washington.
Yeah.
And then in 400 communities or 400 venues across the country, including Columbus, there are other marches at the same time. The events coincide with Earth Day this Saturday, and that's no coincidence. Right, Christian?
No. So in part, it was a scheduling question. There have been so many marches going on in D.C., and we found a weekend where we could do it. But it was also intentional, mixing this with Earth Day to draw some parallels with environmental things as well.
It's a nice – there's so many marches. Was that an issue in Columbus or – everyone else just kind of latched onto it.
Well, definitely. We had the Tax Day March last weekend, and there's a climate march next weekend. So in terms of April, the weekends were pretty full. But we haven't had a lot of pushback on the date. We're coordinating with Earth Day activities, so I think it actually works out really nicely.
What triggered your activism?
Well, I've always been really interested in science as a layperson. And I write about science professionally, but as far as activism, I'm really here more just as a citizen, as a mom, as a grandmother. I'm just really concerned with a disconnect that I see between scientific evidence and actual government policies and priorities. And I think we need to draw attention to that disconnect.
Christian Butner?
So I have to deal with a lot of scientific illiteracy as a teacher at OSU. And it's something that comes across with my students on a regular basis. And so my activism generally was limited to the classroom, if you want to call it activism. It was really just educating people on the issues and with things that are happening currently within the administration when the chance arose to become more active. Through the March for Science, I just jumped on it.
So things happening in the administration, you're talking about the proposed cuts to funding almost across the board of scientific research, that's much of which in the United States is federally funded.
Amongst other things. So the 20% suggested cut to the NIH would be catastrophic. We saw with the sequestration that happened in 2013, I think, which was a 5 to 8% cut, huge amounts of people and huge amounts of labs lost people due to that. The idea of a 20% cut would be pretty catastrophic. But it's not just that. It's also the appointment of someone who doesn't want to have an EPA as the head of the EPA.
Scott Pruitt.
Betsy DeVos, who doesn't really seem to believe in public education as being all that important.
Secretary of Education.
Yep. And other such appointments recently. So it's not just the cuts and the budget. It's just the general approach to scientific topics.
Yeah, because all of whatever is happening, and it, a lot of people say it's highly unlikely these proposed cuts will ever get through Congress. But be that as it may, it is one of the most overt assaults, if you will, on science before. But there's been an undercurrent of anti-science going on for several years now, right, Laura?
I think that's absolutely true. And that's part of what we want to draw attention to with this march. You know, this is not a partisan issue, and it's not an issue that's new with this administration, though certainly were those cuts that we're seeing in the budget have really highlighted it. But I think that there is, that disconnect not only between science and government, but also between science and the public. There's a lot of misunderstanding of what constitutes actual scientific evidence, what peer review means, how we know the things that we know, and how we should be shaping policy around those things. And that's been growing for quite a long time now.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. The March for Science is this Saturday. There's a march in downtown Columbus. You can learn more about it. We'll have a link on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. Right now, we're talking with Christian Butna. He's a OSU graduate student. He's a candidate for his PhD in chemistry, actually, in any second now, almost. And one of the organizers of the Columbus March for Science. Also with us, Laura Sammons, freelance science writer and organizer for the Columbus March for Science. Coming up, I want to hear from listeners, if you will, to give us a call and tell us what you think about this idea of scientists marching in the streets. It's not a common, it's practically, well, I don't think it's ever been done before. So what do you think about this? Give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. We're going to have a couple of people on who are going to talk about the politics of science. We're going to talk about the propaganda of all of this and what it means and how what can be effective, what might not be effective about it. So tell us what you think. You can also check out the Facebook page and let us know there. You know, you were talking, Christian, about how your activism, it used to be limited to the classroom, where you addressed scientific illiteracy in the classroom. And I'm wondering, a lot of people who are lay, Laura Sammons accepted because she's made a profession out of covering science, but most of us don't understand it, don't have an acumen for it. It's not that we're not interested. It's just like we feel like we can't speak the same language. What's your sense about how scientists have, what kind of job they've done in communicating things to people?
So when Laura was talking about the disconnect between the public and scientists, I think that's almost entirely on the scientific community. We, as a general rule, are taught from day one to be as technical and as jargon-heavy as we possibly can, which is fine if we're talking with other experts in the field. And it's terrible when discussing it with literally anyone else. So I think a lot of the problem is on the way scientists communicate their work and communicate any general idea. So we need to do a better job in talking with the public, in breaking down what we do in terms that anyone can understand.
And does the field of science tend to, and Laura Sammons chime in, does the field of science, in your opinion, tend to attract people who are better at talking in jargon and very technically than people who are more comfortable talking generally and with less technicality to it?
I'm not sure if the field attracts people that way, but certainly by the time they get through a master's degree or a PhD, they have learned to be that way. And you know, that's a big part of what I get to do, is talk to scientists and engineers and translate that into something anybody else might want to read. But yes, I do see that being a problem, learning how to speak to the public.
Fluently,
yes.
Science.
It gets beaten out of us with an academic stick from a very early time point onwards.
So what do you do about that? How do you balance?
Yeah, so for me, a big part of it was teaching. So I taught a lot of freshmen, undergraduate freshmen, and you can't go technical on them or they'll just phase out of your classroom. So that's a big part of it for me. I also, as a general rule, before I give a presentation, talk to my mom. She has no scientific background. And if I can make my mother understand, then I think I can make just about anyone understand it.
But do you feel like you're dumbing things down when you do this?
Yes, but I don't think that's a problem. There's no need for someone to understand the intensely technical aspects of what I do to understand what it is I do.
When you think about someone like a Neil deGrasse Tyson, do you like him? Do you like what he's doing? Because I've heard some scientists say, oh, it's pop science, whatever.
I don't have a problem with the pop science. I rather enjoy the idea of bringing scientific topics to the public in a digestible manner. I don't always like the way he does it or the attitude that comes with it sometimes. We have a problem as scientists of being viewed as sort of elitist ivory tower types, and we have a very easy tendency to fall into some level of condescension when discussing this with things of a scientific nature with people who are against it. And I think that's a really dangerous thing to do.
I always think that Laura Sammons, people are fascinated with science. Otherwise, how could movies like A Beautiful Mind and the, what's the one, the science or the, I don't know, any of those science, you know,
Arrival
movies
or...
about science. I mean, science fiction is phenomenal and it's huge. So people care about science, right?
I think they absolutely do. But I think, you know, the movies, particularly the science fiction, are a double-edged sword. They get people interested, but they also spread a lot of misinformation. And a lot of times scientists end up being the villains in those movies, which doesn't help the cause. I would love to see more fiction out there where science is the hero.
And there's a mystery for a lot of people who don't do scientific research is how you come to do scientific research and what it is and what kind of questions you're asking. And sometimes when I hear scientists talk about what they're doing, the questions they're asking are not always something hugely not understandable.
No, it's rarely the question that's the problem. It's you can take a very simple question, but the day-to-day tends to be hyper-technical.
Yeah.
And for what I do, I make cancer imaging agents so that we can detect your cancer early. That's not a difficult concept.
Mm-hmm.
When I get into the details of what we do, it gets significantly more complicated. But most people don't need to know that. Most people don't need to know the details of what I do to understand what I do is, excuse me, is important and helpful.
Does it make you feel unappreciated?
Anyone who's gone to grad school will feel unappreciated. I don't think that's me in particular. I think that's just grad school. But no, I think it's very easy to sort of not understand the hard work behind something you don't do. I've recently become a lot more in touch with some friends who do agricultural work. And while that's always something that I've understood to be backbreaking work, the amount of technical stuff that goes into that as well is just, for me, surprising. But now you don't just get educated on it.
Laura Sammons, what do you hope to accomplish through the Columbus demonstration? What are you shooting for here?
I think a big part of what we want to do is to help people understand that intersection between science, policy, and public life. We get a lot of pushback sometimes on, well, science should be apolitical. And, you know, we really believe that science has to be nonpartisan, but it is not apolitical. It is always a political process. The data itself is not political, but what we do with it is. So when I think about something like the Flint water crisis, you know, we've got data points. We know that there is lead in the water. We know that children there have elevated blood levels. We have conclusions that we can draw from that from a scientific perspective about how that's impacting their lives. And that is all scientific evidence. But what we choose to do with that as a society, that is a political decision, whether we choose to put resources in that. And that's what we really want to draw attention to, is the need for science to be at the table when decisions are made, whether it's budgets or laws or regulations. We have to have science at the table.
Christian Butna, I know that you're going to be wrapping up your final version of your thesis as soon as you leave here today. But after the march on Saturday, how do you extend this? Is there a plan to extend the message of the Saturday march?
Yeah, absolutely. Both on a national level, there's a discussion on how to extend it, and also for us here in Columbus. We have a couple other smaller events we'd like to do that are just meant to wrap the public up in the scientific discussion and get people involved in understanding what science is all about. So while we have some sort of lofty goals, for me on a more personal level, I think my goal is to get people excited, not just to think about the intersection and the more complicated sides of what we do, but just to be more excited about science. And that's particularly true for the younger generation. We want kids to get excited about science.
This is very different for me. My experience has always been calls for more STEM education, blah, 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 more science education. Always feels like it's coming from without. And this is the first time I feel like the calls for this clarion call is coming from within very strongly.
I think that's true. I think the science community tends to be a little insular and wrapped up in their ivory towers, per se. And I think there has been a sense that they didn't need to be actively involved and to have a political voice. And I think what we've been seeing, especially recently, has demonstrated that teachers, scientists, other people who care about science do need to get involved.
But Christian, this is not without critics, right? You've heard a few yourself.
Yeah, so there's always pushback when scientists want to get involved in something that isn't considered 100% just science. And that's not a new concept. Jonas Salk, who discovered the first polio vaccine, wrote a book in the 70s, and he said as soon as scientists begin to look at what he called the problems of man and not just observe the universe, they're going to get political and people aren't going to be happy about it. But I think anyone who thinks science and politics aren't already linked isn't really paying attention. Anyone who gets federal funding, their work becomes political. Whether it's overtly politicized by Congress on the floor, they took a bunch of studies that were pushed by the NIH and the NSF and criticized the concepts behind them and why are we funding this, to just worrying about getting paid again. We're all somehow linked into the political system. We just need to recognize that, accept it, and do something about it.
All right. That's Christian Boutna. He's an OSU PhD candidate. One of the organizers of the Columbus March for Science. Also, Laura Sammons, freelance science writer and organizer for the Columbus March for Science. Thanks for joining us today. I appreciate it.
Thanks
for having us.
And once again, listeners, I'm looking for people both for and against the March on Science and this effort from within the science community to get more support for what they do in the current climate. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Research has shown that both liberals and conservatives are biased when it comes to science. Climate change, fracking, vaccines, stem cell research are a few of the prominent issues that divide along political fault lines. We're going to talk about the intersection of science and politics today, what works and what doesn't, and how actions in Washington have inspired the March for Science in Washington and four other cities, including Columbus, on Saturday. Joining us is OSU Associate Professor of Communication Eric Nisbet. His research focuses on politicization and public attitudes toward science. Welcome back.
Thank you very much.
Also, by phone, political scientist with the Center for Science and Technology Policy Research at the University of Colorado, Roger Pelkey. He has written extensively on science and politics, including the 2010 book, The Climate Fix, What Scientists and Politicians Won't Tell You About Global Warming. Welcome to the show, Roger Pelkey.
Thank you.
You've written about how science and politics have intersected throughout history. We have this sense that there's a separation, a bright line, but that's never been the case, really, right?
Yeah, anytime that you bring knowledge, expertise into a process where you're making decisions, it's inevitably going to be political. It doesn't necessarily have to be strongly partisan. Some issues get strongly partisan. But when you make decisions, it's inevitably political.
But the people who are debating the issues aren't necessarily, they all may be political, but they're not all scientists.
That's true. And one of the wonderful things about science is that it belongs to all of us, even if you're not a PhD. And the folks we elect in democracies represent everyone, not just experts. So we do have this complex mix of technocrats and democracy that makes it really difficult to use expertise in making decisions.
And it's easy to say, perhaps, that now things are so technical, how can politicians possibly know what they're talking about? But that's always been the case anyway, right?
It is. But, I mean, as society has advanced, as technology has advanced, there are many decisions that are based on information that is highly technical. And it's not just what we think of as science. You know, foreign relations and economics are also highly technical and require experts. So part of modern democracy is trying to figure out how do we make best use of experts while preserving what we value so much in democratic processes.
Eric Nisbet, we were talking earlier about how sometimes, you know, scientists just aren't, they kind of have it beat out of them, the ability to communicate with normal people, ordinary mortals, right, about what they do.
Sure, sure. It can be very difficult for scientists. Scientists are people, too, and they have their own biases, right? And whether it be social biases, class biases, or political biases. So especially when they're trying to talk about issues across lines of difference, it can be especially difficult for them to get outside their own bubble as well.
How who does do that well?
Well, who are the best science communicators out there? Well, I think Bill Nye, Neil deGrasse Tyson, some others have become celebrity scientists. But at the end of the day, I think really for science to be effective, it's not so much focusing on celebrity scientists. It's really scientists getting more involved in their community. Right? Scientists going to PTA meetings, scientists going to local churches, for example, and speaking to people of faith, really trying to cut across at their local level, getting out in the community and meeting people who are different from themselves. My brother, who's also a social scientist, put out a report about 4 or 5 years ago, maybe more, and he looked at sort of the ideological distance of different groups and looked at how scientists compared to other groups in the United States, other ideological groups. And based upon sort of a membership survey of AAAS, the main science advocacy and membership association in the United States, he found that scientists on average had the same ideological distance from the average person as the Tea Party. Right. So scientists are very liberal. They have their own sort of educational political biases. And that can also sort of sometimes create their own influence them to view the world that doesn't really connect with the average person. So getting out into the community, getting more involved and trying to cut across lines of difference, I think is something that would be most effective in terms of science communication.
Roger Pelkey, is the United States unique in this debate over science and the relevance of it when it comes to public policy?
It's not. One of the things that stands out internationally, certainly in Europe and in the United States, is how highly scientists are held in esteem by the public. There's few institutions. The military, maybe doctors, are held in high esteem and have been. There's others, members of Congress, journalists, who are down near the bottom. Mm-hmm. But science in general is widely respected in many places. It's when you get to specific issues like climate change, like fracking, like GMOs, where people get very sharp partisan perspectives, which aren't necessarily a reflection of what they think about science in general. They're reflections of what they think about those issues.
So where then did this anti-science thing emerge? Is it a thing, or is it just something that's been played out by the media?
Yeah, I don't think it's something played out by the media. It's a convenient tag because science is so widely held in high regard. If you tar your opponent, whether you're on the left or the right, as anti-science, it has some punch. It has some meaning because no one wants to be seen as anti-science. So the idea of being pro or anti-science has gotten caught up in our partisan debates, and we see it thrown around because science is such a valued institution in our society.
Can I just say, echo something that Roger just pointed out, which is true, is that if you look at polling in the United States, science, only next to the military, is the sort of the singular institution that people have a lot of faith and trust and confidence in, more so than
across
Congress.
Across the board?
Across media, Congress, other institutions or society. But that's one of the dangers when you have mobilization like this March for Science, is whether science sort of fitters away its credibility across political lines of difference. If you are seen as mobilizing in a highly partisan way, of being part of the resistance to Trump, to sort of linking yourself to very partisan issues as an institution, right, then you might actually start sacrificing some of that confidence that has sort of built up over time in the United States.
So if when I said across the board, I meant in terms of people's support for science.
Across,
it doesn't matter what faith you are, socioeconomic level you are.
Republicans might have, if you look at liberals and conservatives, Republicans, Democrats, yes, conservatives and Republicans might have less confidence in science compared to liberals, but they still have more confidence in science than other institutions. So it's all relative. Even among conservatives, science is at the high level of compared to other institutions like Congress, like the media, or other types of institutions in our country. So there might be some partisan differences between the groups, but within each group, science is still paramount.
So then, Roger Pelkey, where's the disconnect coming from?
I'm not sure there is a disconnect.
Okay.
If you take a look at science funding, say, over time,
mm-hmm.
You can certainly identify partisan difference about how members of Congress vote. Military R&D and basic research tends to be favored by Republicans, environmental research by Democrats. But overall, over time, the most important factor for how much money science gets is what's called the domestic discretionary budget. It's the part of the budget that's not military that Congress gets to vote on every year. And science goes up and down with that. And so claims, for example, this year that there's an anti-science trend in Trump's budget proposal really reflects that Trump has to fund this increase for the military, and it's got to come from somewhere, and science is one of the targets. But historically, Republicans and Democrats have been strong supporters of science. So I think that the tenor of this claim of anti-science and so on reflects our partisan politics that we see throughout our society taking root inside our politics of science.
There are other examples that aren't necessarily partisan that come out too when we pardon me, when we talk about, you know, the mere legalization of cannabis. It's shocking to some people how little research has been done on it, how much little we actually know. And that crosses political lines, right?
Eric Nesbitt? Well, I mean, I think when you talk about funding of specific science issues, it's I think Roger's right. It's who's science, right? So, you know, in terms of funding research on cannabis, though you can say it cuts across political issues, there has always been conservatives are less likely to fund research that might lead to legalization of drugs, for example. They have been reticent in funding research that looks at gun violence, for example.
Mm-hmm, right.
At the same time, they're more likely to fund research that informs business and industry, right? And if you look at some of the studies that go out there, when you ask Americans not how they feel about science in the abstract, about different types of scientists, you see a clear divide. Liberals favor environmental scientists, life scientists, scientists who study those type of topics, and conservatives favor scientists who study chemistry, physics, that have more industry applications, agriculture, for example. So, you know, it often when you talk about support for science, it's whose science are you talking about? There's lots of liberals out there who feel very strongly about nuclear power as being against it and would be very critical of scientists who argue that we should have more nuclear power plants. But if you look at a recent survey at AAAS in 2014, 88% of scientists favor building more nuclear power plants in the United States.
Hmm.
That's a huge divide and between scientists feel and how maybe the liberal base feels about a very significant scientific issue.
And then to a certain extent, Roger Pelkey, caught in the middle are the scientists themselves who are just want to know more about the world.
Yeah, often that's the case. I mean, I'll give you another example along the lines of what Eric just said. Is in the last few weeks, there was a major bill passed by Congress, signed by the president, to add more money to weather forecasting. Weather is a bipartisan issue. Everyone sees the value of weather forecasting. It's not a Republican or a Democratic issue. But if that happened to be a climate bill rather than a weather bill, it would be a huge food fight because our partisan politics have taken root in that particular area of science, but not in weather. So,
are we even aware of this? I mean, you've analyzed it, but are politicians even aware? Do you know?
Aware of?
That they're making those distinctions in that way.
You know, I think that politicians, their job is to politicize issues and to have sharp distinctions to help people decide, you know, who they want to vote for.
Mm-hmm.
And so that when politicians do their job, they tend to pick, you know, some of the most extreme claims on either side of an issue, whether it's nuclear power or GMOs. And in some respects, that's how democracy works. Scientists and particularly leaders of scientific institutions have to be careful not to get caught up in that because it's not the job of scientists to be politicians. So when science does become important at high level politics, it can be very seductive and attractive for scientists to say, I want to play in that political process. But sometimes the best thing we can do as experts is support processes, not jump into the fray.
You have an email from Rich who writes, science uses hard empirical evidence along with critical thinking of reality. Politics is not a science. Evidence and critical thinking are very rarely used. Do we actually see any critical thinking, let alone evidence-based decision-making in the people involved in politics today? And I think you kind of just answered that question, Roger Pelkey.
Yeah.
We are going to take a quick break. We're talking about politics and science today. Want to hear from our listeners. What do you think about the march in Washington, the March for Science? There's another one in Columbus. There are 399 other marches for science coming up this Saturday around the country. Give us a call and tell us what you think. Yay, nay. I'm going to ask my guests, too. Eric Nisbet, Associate Professor of Communication at OSU, and also Roger Pelkey, Political Scientist with the Center for Science and Technology Policy Research at the University of California. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about the intersection of science and politics today and how scientists can engage in politics without losing their credibility. Thousands of scientists and their supporters will march across the country for science this Saturday, making it the biggest political demonstration among scientists ever. The big march is, as of course, in Washington. There are about 400 others, including one in Columbus this Saturday. We'll have a link to our website at WOSU.org/allsides if you want to learn more about that. Still with us is OSU Associate Professor of Communication, Eric Nisbet. Thanks again for joining us.
Thank you.
And by phone, political scientist with the Center for Science and Technology Policy Research at the University of Colorado, Roger Pelkey. Roger, thanks again for joining us.
Thank you.
So, Roger Pelkey, what do you think about this March for Science? Are thumbs up, thumbs down? What?
Yeah, well, I think it's great. I mean, I think as a matter of democracy and people expressing their views, it's a wonderful thing for people to get out and be engaged. And it allows us to have this sort of conversation, not just about politics and science, but diversity in science, the role of women in science, power, and so on. So I think it's a great opportunity for scientists and people who care about scientists to really explore important issues.
Are there any depends associated with that, depending on anything particular?
I think, you know, part of the conversation that we are having and we should be having is the role of science in politics. And what's important for the science community is not so much the march itself, but what happens after? What lessons are learned? Are we more sophisticated? Are we smarter about how we engage the political process? I think it's really important to, you know, to put out there that, you know, without the election of Donald Trump, you know, this march is probably not happening under President Hillary Clinton. So there is a strong political overtone, sometimes explicit here, that we ought to be talking about.
And Eric Nisbet, you think maybe that's part of the problem?
Well, I maybe I'm a little more skeptical than Roger. I do worry about the march. I guess my hope for the march at best is that it does no harm. I'm very sympathetic. I have a lot of friends who are participating, who'll be out there marching. But, you know, I talked to several other colleagues who study sort of the science of science communication and science and politics. And the vast majority of them were thought that this march possibly was ill-advised in the sense that it seems more of a tactic in search of a strategy than a strategy itself. We all know the media does not do a good job of covering protest marches. And, you know, depending what signs are there, what aspects of the march they highlight.
If there's any conflict at all.
If there's any conflict at all, that's going to sort of taint, I think, what might be the overall goal of the march is to highlight science. And as well as I think there is – I know it would be very cathartic for a lot of people who have very strong feelings about the Trump administration, about our current political situation. At the same time, you know, science does have a lot of credibility, as we're talking about, across lines of difference. And the question is this really the best way to approach some more fundamental issues of politics, policy, and science that we need to deal with. And there's the possibility of going off message. The organizers of this march represent a very sort of liberal base, and they are very focused on life sciences. And originally, the sort of the impetus of this march was partly because of the Trump administration's moves on climate science, right? And so if you focus – if the march focuses too much on certain types of science or defending certain types of science versus other science, that will add to the politicization, as well as, you know, the Twitter account for the march basically was heavily criticized in the conservative media because it posted some tweets that sort of attacked or criticized the Trump administration for dropping the mother of all bombs on ISIS in Afghanistan, which is very off message. That's not really about science, but it basically tweeted out a message talking about how this is how science can be weaponized to marginalize certain groups. And so it was quickly deleted when people pushed back on it. But the potential for this type of mobilization to go off message and actually further divide us about science rather than bring us together is there and needs to be careful about.
You know, Roger Pelkey, you wrote about science in terms of propaganda, that the science community should offer evidence-based policy alternatives across the spectrum of government to those being put forward by the Trump administration. And I was wondering, given what, you know, Eric Nesbitt just said, who takes the helm of such an enterprise? Who gets to say?
Well, I mean, in a democracy, we all get to say. And one of the wonderful things about science is that all sides have access to science. So one of the troubling aspects of the march, and I'll agree with Eric here, is that it is a rather blunt instrument. You have, you know, really some of the smartest people in the country, and there are a lot of strategies involving politics or propaganda to counter Trump's very effective propaganda. We have a lot of experts who know that that the Democrats and others opposed to Trump could draw on. In terms of policy, you're not going to beat bad policies with marches. You're going to beat bad policies with better policies. And so if the Trump administration is putting forward bad climate change policies in the eyes of many scientists, the way they're going to defeat those policies is to come up with better policies that are more broadly supported by a larger group of politicians and their constituents.
But aren't scientists going to want to put forth policies that aren't necessarily political but are scientifically validated?
There's no such thing as policies that aren't political.
Okay.
You can have policies that are consistent with scientific understandings.
Yeah, I guess, yeah.
But that doesn't really narrow you down very much. Take climate change. There's an enormous scope of things that could be done to decarbonize our economy. In our public debates, we've only had access to a few. So scientists could come up with more Republican, heartland-friendly policies and put them forward in addition to marching and expressing their values.
And Eric Nesbitt, getting back to what you were saying about who's going to show up on Saturday, whether it's in Columbus or Washington or wherever, are you saying that it's going to be somebody involved in stem cell research versus somebody involved in nuclear energy research?
What I'm saying is most likely, if you look at sort of the ideological makeup of this march, it'll be heavily on the liberal side. It'll be heavily on probably younger scientists and allies. It will definitely have a vein running through it of anti-Trump and probably pro climate change policy perspectives in terms of addressing climate change. So I think it's not necessarily going to be appealing to the Trump voter. It's not going to be appealing to conservatives in both who is marching and probably some of its core messages, especially if it veers off topic beyond starts dealing with political issues that are outside of a narrow range of talking about scientifically informed decision making. But I think what needs to be done is. On the flip side, though, there could be a positive, and the positive is that it is an expression of democracy where scientists and allies possibly mobilize and create networks, right? That move on, that maybe they through this march get better organized to do some more longer term, more strategically focused events or approaches to deal with the root issue, which is making sure that we serve in a way, defend the integrity of science and the use of evidence in policymaking, which I think is something that needs to be talked about and debated in our society. But whether this approach is the best way to do it, I think, is problematic.
We have an email from Cynthia. She says, voters and political leaders who dismiss science have exposed the limitations of our democracy and our species. Politicians prefer ignorant voters. Roger Pelkey, do you think that's the case?
No, I don't think that's the case. Not at all. Walter Lippmann, who was a commentator of the 20th century, said that the goal of politics is not to get everybody to think alike, but to help people who think differently to act alike. And I think there's some wisdom there. Not everyone has to agree on everything for democracy to work. And because you disagree with someone doesn't make them necessarily an ignorant and you smart. And similarly, on 99.9% of topics, all of us experts are pretty much ignorant because we focus on a specific topic and we drill down deep. So democracy, by its very nature, is about helping a bunch of us ignoramuses act together, because no one, not a politician, not a scientist, can be expert on all the things that a modern, big democratic system like the United States has to deal with on a daily basis.
Yeah. I wanted to talk to both of you about the issue of fake news and whether you feel like that's part of the whole climate change denial or climate the whole denier issue has to do with fake news. Roger Pelkey?
Yeah, the issue of fake news is a real one, and it is problematic. But it has become kind of muddied because the term fake news has become used to just tar the opponent who you happen to disagree with these days. And the climate change issue is a great one where we talk about alarmists and deniers and we act like we're fighting about science, but what we're really fighting about is economics and politics. If the discussion of climate change, in my view, was about policy options, what should we do with nuclear power? What should we do with subsidies for renewable energy and so on, rather than temperature trends or extreme weather, we'd make a lot more progress, I think, debating the issue.
Eric Nisbet?
Well, I think the use of disinformation in whether it's around an issue like climate change or other political issues or whether it's an international politics used by Russia, for example, is actually has been going on for a very, very long time. So fake news unto itself is not necessarily new. I think there's a new attention to it. But is disinformation and fake news part of the climate change debate? There has been strategic use of information on both sides over the years and to promote certain policy or politics. I think more fundamentally, I think, though, this fascination with fake news in our society, and I've been talking to some other scholars about it more globally than just about science, has to deal with, I think, issues of populism, inequality, and it goes beyond the United States. And I think what science can do and what scientists can do best to address issues of fake news or whether it's climate change or just political polarization in our society more broadly, I think that's part of the key issues that science should try to address proactively, and because fake news is a symptom of not the cause, is the idea that we need to get out, as I mentioned in the beginning of this segment, get into our communities as scientists and work across lines of difference, right? Talk to Republican politicians, talk to local politicians, basically help deal with issues of inequality, issues of polarization and depolarize our society. Because as someone who studies also international politics, I can tell you polarization and inequality are these two huge issues in the United States, which are almost in some ways just as deadly as other people would make out climate change to be in terms of the long-term health of our society and our body politic. And I think science has a role and scientists have a role to play in dealing not only things like climate change, but these other issues. I'm just not sure if the march is the best way to do that.
Roger Pelkey?
Yeah, I think one of the really important issues following up on Eric is that we often talk about how important it is for politicians and the public to become more scientifically literate. I also think it goes the other way,
yes,
that it's really important for experts and scientists in particular to become more politically literate. One of the issues that we've seen in the past year with the rise of the Trump voter and Donald Trump being elected is that there's a significant disaffected class of people who suffered the consequences of innovation, productivity growth, globalization, all of which can be traced back to advances in science-based technology. Mm-hmm. If we are able to create industrial robots or better supply chains, that affects people's lives. And I think experts need to better understand the consequences of what we do when we're making these wonderful advances and how they affect people and how that turns into populism and outcomes that maybe many scientists don't appreciate.
I mean, that premise that scientists don't unravel what they do into the future and see what the effects could be is the premise of many a great science fiction.
That's true. That's true. The idea of unforeseen circumstances, the idea of the mad scientist or the sort of this Pandora's box, as my brother has written about when you let the genie out of the bottle and you can't put it back in. That is, and that often, and I think, and you know, if you study science fiction, you'll see that over time, each generation has a new science. Right. Whether it's the atomic
rocket
era,
science, right.
You know, rocket science, the nuclear, genetics, for example, nanotechnology. But I think, you know, and Roger and I think agree on this, is that sense that scientists, it's good for scientists to get out of the laboratory. It's good for them to get engaged with politics and policy as well as their local communities. However, what you want to do in a way that doesn't increase political polarization, right, and increase lines of difference and increase this perception of us versus them, which a march can do, right, versus other types of strategies in terms of communication. Now, Roger wrote a piece about scientists and a new form of propaganda in the Guardian, which mm-hmm. I enjoyed. I wouldn't necessarily use the word propaganda. I might use the term public diplomacy because
propaganda is a loaded.
It's
loaded
a loaded
word.
Term. And talking to some of my friends when I shared Roger's piece, some of my scientist friends, they got their they're a little ruffled by that. But I think scientists do need a form of public diplomacy, which is again the same idea: is creating new lines of communication, new forms of communication. But that communication has to be two ways. It's not one way. It's not scientists only communicating to the public. The scientists have to listen to the public as well.
Yeah, and Roger, you brought up the other issue, and you alluded to it a little earlier, that science as an industry has its own issues as well, particularly when it comes to diversity and that kind of a thing.
Yeah, Eric cited the AAAS, American Association for Advancement of Science, survey of mm-hmm. their members, which found that only 6% admitted or signed the survey as being Republicans. So science, at least academic science and government science, is not reflective of the country at large. And so you have this risk of a lack of viewpoint diversity in science where many scientists will reflect the views, in this case, of the Democratic Party. And there is a risk. I agree with Eric that if science comes to be viewed as a supporting arm of one political party and not the other, why would we be surprised that science becomes politicized? And science has a long history, many decades of being able to be bipartisan, above the fray in some sense, even as individual scientists participate here and there. And I think a lot of attention needs to be paid to preserving that kind of special relationship with the American public rather than trying to politicize it. Because we're going to need science going forward, no matter what our political differences.
And I'm just wondering, scientists not only don't spend their time doing this kind of thing typically, but they don't necessarily have the resources to do it either. They put their resources into their science.
Right.
Who and I guess I was kind of wondering who takes the helm of such an enterprise when I asked you that earlier is who pays for all of this? I mean, who's going to do this? Eric Nisbet?
Well, there are, different scientific associations. There's AAAS.
But those aren't the people in the trenches.
They are, but they're supposed to reflect, but they're the ones that are supposed to worry about strategic issues like this, right? Now, they can provide resources to people in the trenches, provide training, and they have the National Academies for Science, AAAS. They have been engaged on this issue, but they haven't been engaged in the issue in a sort of a contentious politics protest paradigm like this march on Saturday. And this march actually didn't come from these associations. It was not a top down. It was very much a bottom up. younger scientists, postdocs, you know, posted this on Facebook. It went viral. And much like you see, I think a similar metaphor would be the division between the Democratic establishment and the base and how to deal with Trump, where whether there's accommodation or not between the establishment and Trump is felt very differently among the base who just went resistance. And I think that's part of the struggle going on here.
Eric Nisbet, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Eric Nisbet, Associate Professor of Communications at OSU, and also Roger Pelkey, political scientist with the Center for Science and Technology Policy Research at the University of Colorado. Thanks to you as well.
Thanks for having me.
And thanks to intern Sarah Stacey for producing today's show. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.